Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in History. I'm Marshall Poe, your host. Each week we pick a new history book that we find particularly interesting, and we interview the author of that book. This week, I'm happy to say we have Amy Bass on the show, and we will be talking about her new book, Those About Him Remain Silent, The Battle Over W.E.B. Du Bois. I asked my wife, who is from Western Massachusetts, if she knew who W.E.B. Du Bois was, and of course she did. Most Americans know that Du Bois was one of the founders of the modern American civil rights movement. I then asked her if she knew where Du Bois was born and raised, and she did not, even though she was, in fact, from a town not at all far from Du Bois's birthplace, that being Great Barrington, Massachusetts, in the Berkshires. Now, this is somewhat surprising because my wife, a well-educated person from the area, really should have known this. And it's hard to understand why she wouldn't know this because he is an extraordinarily famous fellow. Amy Bass has written a book entirely about the phenomenon of remembering and forgetting Du Bois in Western Massachusetts and the nation at large. Du Bois was a complicated figure. He was black, and Western Massachusetts is predominantly white. Du Bois was a civil rights leader, and Western Massachusetts is known as a very progressive place that supported civil rights, but he was also, later in his life, a communist, and Western Massachusetts is not known as a place that supported communism. So after Du Bois died in 1963, I believe there was some question about how to remember him or if the people of Great Barrington should remember him at all. Amy chronicles the debate very well in the book, and we had a really interesting discussion about the place of historical memory, of public history, of the way in which people craft the past in order to make it fit the agendas of the present. This is still going on today. You can think about Tea Parties. Why is the Tea Party movement called the Tea Party movement? Well, you know, they've borrowed that particular tag from an episode that most Americans will know. In any event, I really enjoyed talking to Amy today, and I'm sure that you'll enjoy the interview. Here it is. Hi, Amy.
Hi, Marshall.
How are you today?
I'm just fine, thank you. How are you?
Very well. Well, you know, the weather here in Iowa is absolutely gorgeous. We have really beautiful springs. I, however, have hay fever, so it's not so good for me. How about the weather there in New Rochelle?
We're finally starting to get some green going on, so I think we're heading into spring quite well at this point.
I'm very happy to hear that. We have Amy Bass on the show today, and we'll be talking about her really interesting and provocative, I would say provocative, new book, Those About Him Remain Silent, The Battle Over W.E.B. Du Bois. I have read the book cover to cover, and as I say, I was challenged on every page to rethink what I know about W.E.B. Du Bois, which I have to say really isn't a whole lot, being a Russian historian by training. But I highly recommend the book to anyone interested in Du Bois, or particularly the issue of historical memory. And I would say the book really is a contribution to the literature on historical memory. To begin the interview, Amy, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself.
Okay. I grew up in New England, about 16 miles north of where Du Bois was born, in a little town called Richmond. Went to college in Maine at Bates and majored in history, mostly because I didn't want to turn my love for literature into a chore, so I dropped my English major. So went with history and kind of ended up in graduate school by default, but started working with just this amazing group of people at Stony Brook University in the doctoral program there. Uh-huh. And was really lucky to be, I think, the only one who did doctoral work at Stony Brook in the history department at the same time that Matthew Jacobson and Nikhil Pal Singh were both there. They uh-huh. They both overlapped by a very brief period of time. And I think I'm the only product of that overlap. So I was really, you know, fortunate in that to have these two, you know, amazing minds of American studies, Matt's now at Yale and Nikhil's at NYU, to get me going and to get my mind working in ways that I didn't know it was going to.
What was your dissertation in first? You have a couple of books. And
yeah, my dissertation was about the 1968 Olympic Games and the Black Power movements that came out of them, about Tommy Smith and John Carlos mm-hmm. and the Olympic Project for Human Rights. So
and that Finnish guy. Wasn't he Finnish?
No, Australian.
Australian?
Peter Norman.
Guy. Yeah.
Yeah, the silver medalist.
Yeah.
Who wore a button of support for
yeah.
his two American colleagues.
Right.
So, and that turned into my first book, and mm-hmm. you know, it was an interesting project. It was one that could have dangerously gotten me pigeonholed as a sports historian. Mm-hmm. It's not really a sports history. It's a civil rights history.
Mm-hmm.
And so from there, I did go on to edit a series of essays for my second book about sports, which mm-hmm. is the book In the Game. But the kind of twist on that is that I asked non-sports people to write the essays.
Uh-huh.
So it's a really eclectic group of people that are really good at what they do, thinking about what they do within a sports context.
Mm-hmm.
And then the Du Bois book,
yeah.
which just came out last fall.
If I could just give a plug for the Stony Brook History Program, I happen to know it is fantastic. I have a colleague that works there, a very brilliant guy named Gary Marker.
Absolutely.
And it's really a fantastic place.
He was chair of the department when I was there.
Pretty much any place associated with Gary Marker is going to be a fantastic place in mind, but it's a terrific program. So I'm not surprised
really
that it produces the stars that now light up the sky. In any event, tell me how you came to write Those About Him Remain Silent.
The Du Bois book came out of a moment that I actually had at Stony Brook in a seminar with Nikhil Pal Singh. We were reading Paul Gilroy's book, The Black Atlantic, and there was just a passing mention of Du Bois growing up in Great Barrington in the Berkshires in Massachusetts, in western Massachusetts. I think I must have been a third-year student at that point and had obviously read quite a bit of Du Bois and, you know, considered myself a complete guru about the Berkshires, and this was such sort of almost it was shocking to me to find out that Du Bois had been born in Great Barrington. I did not know that I actually kind of rebelled against it. I went to Nikhil and said, well, this isn't true. And he said, well, yeah, it is. And I said, oh, no, it's not. And he said, yeah, it is. So I started doing some digging and found out that, yeah, sure enough, Du Bois had been born in Great Barrington. Paul Gilroy, of course, had not made a mistake. So I called my parents, who are both journalists, still in the Berkshires, writing for the Berkshire Eagle, and said, you know, did you guys know? And, of course, parents always know, so their answer was yes. And then they said that there had been some skirmishes about it in the late 60s, early 70s, that their friends had been somewhat involved in about trying to memorialize his birthplace. So I kind of put it on the back burner. I had a lot to do. I was, you know, about to defend a dissertation proposal and go through that whole thing, but it was something that I always wanted to come back to, and when I came back to it, it turned into this.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I see. Well, that sounds good. I mean, it sounds like a really terrific project for you because you have roots in the area. I know that I find myself in the age of the internet looking up my hometown a lot, trying to figure out what I don't know about it, which turns out to be a lot. The most famous person, it's sort of interesting in the autobiographical sense, is the most famous person from Kansas, who is Dwight David Eisenhower, I would say.
Mm-hmm.
Every Kansan knows that Dwight David Eisenhower is from Kansas, except that he's not. So we have sort of the opposite case. You know,
it's a problematic memory.
Yes, we have adopted Dwight David Eisenhower, but he's not really ours. So in any event, maybe you could just begin by telling us who W.E.B. Du Bois was, because I think there are a lot of people, especially those who listen overseas, who might not know who he was.
Yeah, I think that the grandest way to summarize Du Bois is to use the phrase that he was the architect of the modern civil rights movement. The more specific thing that tends to follow him around, you know, the reason that he's on a postage stamp, for example, is that he was a co-founder of the NAACP. He's a difficult person to summarize because he was such a prolific thinker. He was such a prolific writer. He was someone that explored so many different ways to understand the world and economics and justice and humanity to the point where, you know, after trying on just about every worldview there was, he wrote some of his own ideas such as Pan-Africanism and what have you. He's difficult to corral. I mean, he died at the age of 95. Mm-hmm. He published over 4,000 pieces.
Mm-hmm.
He has an ideological evolution that I would say is unparalleled in the 20th century and maybe ever. And he is, unfortunately, best known for the last decision that he made within this ideological evolution, and that is at the age of 93, he joined the Communist Party
mm-hmm.
Just before expatriating himself to Ghana,
mm-hmm.
Where he died 2 years later on the eve of the March of Washington. He actually
mm-hmm.
died the night before
mm-hmm.
The march took place in D.C. that August.
But I think we should say also, and tell me if I'm correct in this characterization, that he has now been, I want to say canonized, but his star has risen now. He is well known to everyone in academia in the United States, and I didn't even even know he was a communist at the end of his life. I really didn't.
And many would say that he really wasn't.
Yeah, I didn't even catch that. I know him from The Souls of Black Folks and some other things. I know that he's widely read in African American studies departments everywhere. He's really one of the people that is always mentioned in connection with the civil rights movement. So he's widely known now. I don't think that was always the case.
I think he's had, there's been an interesting relationship with him in academia. I mean, certainly, he was respected and certainly considered part of a canon. But to, being known in academia doesn't necessarily mean that you have much of an impact anywhere else.
to say that very mildly.
Yeah. And the other thing with it is in terms of what I discovered writing this book, the book doesn't really have a happy ending. It has a cautious ending. Mm-hmm. Because there is still a lot of venom and a lot of animosity about the legacy of Du Bois, because of those communist affiliations and because of some more insidious reasons, as I try to point out.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I see. So
one of the frames of the book, one of the topics and themes of the book, as I mentioned, is historical memory. And really one of the things that the book investigates is the attempt of the people of Great Barrington, Massachusetts. I actually know Great Barrington a little bit. My wife is from Northampton. And so I've been out there. It's in the Berkshires. Maybe you could tell us a little bit about Great Barrington and also how Du Bois' ancestors got there.
Okay, which is partially a question better suited for David Levering Lewis and his fantastic biographies of Du Bois. Great Barrington is kind of the center of South County, the Berkshires. The Berkshires span north to south, Vermont to Connecticut, with New York on the western border. It's a different state in a way. I mean, Massachusetts really breaks up. There's Boston, and then there's everybody else. Mm-hmm. And then within the everybody else, the Berkshires are the really far away everybody else.
I would say there's Boston, Worcester, and every place else.
and then keep going for another hour and a half, and you're going to hit the borders of the Berkshires. It's a very conflicted place in terms of that. I mean, I will admit that there are Yankee fans in the Berkshires because of the proximity to New York State.
Uh-huh.
But it's a place that became quite early on in the 19th century a haven for New Yorkers. It is not a haven for Bostonians, but it has become a place of summertime for New Yorkers. And because of that, it has a very particular cultural edge to it. And has for a long time, whether it was, the likes of Nathaniel Hawthorne and Herman Melville and people like that inhabiting the Berkshires in the 19th century, all the way through to the cultural festivals and the major theater groups and the summer home of the Boston Symphony Orchestra and, the Norman Rockwell Museum and all of these different things that make it, it's the self-proclaimed cultural resort, premier cultural resort of America. Which is, a stupid thing to say about a place, but also I think kind of well earned.
Mm-hmm.
So it makes it a very complex place. It's physically stunning. It's culturally deep. It has a very large rural local population that is very different from its visiting summer population. It has, a huge community of artists and intellectuals and what have you. It has, some really great educational institutions. Williams College is in the northern part of the county. So it makes for a very complex place. It's also quintessentially New England. It's very proud of its New England heritage, of its northern heritage, of its own history. And Du Bois sucked a lot of that up. I mean, he was, as he writes in one of his autobiographies, quintessentially New England. The way he dressed, the way he spoke, the way he, kind of assumed things about people had a very New England stake about it.
Mm-hmm.
And his family was there for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
And his family got there the way any family's, any African-American heritage was going to. He had ancestors that participated in the rebellions of the American Revolution. He had ties to one of the more famous slave families in the area. His family was there for a long time, which means that his stake in Berkshire history isn't just that of him and his own legacy, but also in terms of African American life in early New England.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Was he the only? There were very few African Americans in Great Barrington in the 19th century.
That's true. there were some, though. I mean, there was, you know, the larger black communities in Massachusetts were going to be in Boston and also on Martha's Vineyard. But there was a core group within the Berkshires, both Great Barrington had, you know, a good percentage, which still doesn't mean very many. But his family did have, you know, longstanding roots there. But yeah, it was but a handful. It wasn't a large community. And within that community, you know, he and his mother attended a different church than most of the black residents in Great Barrington, largely because of their proximity to it. So he, even within, you know, the smallness of African American life in Great Barrington, he and his mother were outside of that for a variety of reasons.
Mm-hmm. One thing I wanted to have you speak a little bit about, because it was sort of shocking to me, is the way in which he describes, Great Barrington, I mean, as you say, he was an incredibly prolific writer. The way he describes his childhood, at least at some moments in Great Barrington, and it is it's sort of in the elegiac mode, I guess I would say. He says things like there was no discrimination.
Yeah, I mean, it's really a binary for a legacy, because Du Bois writes about Great Barrington quite a lot in his autobiographical writings, and Du Bois is kind of fantastic in that he rewrites his autobiography several times throughout his life, and they are all very different from one another, which is just a great thing about autobiography in general.
The brand new day policy.
Yeah, and you know, his what I would consider the definitive autobiography is the last one, which he wrote, you know, when he was, you know, almost at the end. But even, you know, The Souls of Black Folk, which what I would, you know, his essays, which I would think most would argue is his most famous work, have a lot of autobiographical pieces in them. So he writes that but one of the consistencies within all of these autobiographies is the way he writes about his home, both how beautiful it was. He writes really poetically about the Berkshires and its beauty, but also about his relatively uncomplicated youth, which is saying a lot because he was a black kid growing up in New England, in rural New England, with a single mother. You know, part of an extended network, but his father flew away pretty quickly, pretty early on. So it's an interesting scenario. Mm-hmm. So on the one hand, you know, the town supports him. He's valedictorian of his high school class. The town kind of closes ranks, to borrow from his own language, to send him to college, to provide him with books, to really help him. They understood that someone exceptional was within their community in Will Du Bois. Which is really something that the town took pride in. And yet at the same time, he writes in Souls of Black Folk about, you know, the first time he discovers the veil, what he calls the veil, which is, you know, that ethereal thing that separates white and black America. And that was from an experience in a Great Barrington school situation, mm-hmm. With one of his classmates, a girl who would not share a name card with him. Mm-hmm. So it works in a lot of different ways. In a lot of different directions. Du Bois is not one for ever giving the easy answer, which is why he's so prolific. So I think that on the one hand, yes, he you know, continually writes in these beautiful ways about his childhood. He grants a lot of recognition to people like his high school principal for getting him where he got to. And at the same time, he recognizes that it was within the confines of Great Barrington that he first began to understand the tensions of race.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. You know, I found that episode very, very interesting. And then he goes to college, and he first goes to Fisk University,
right?
Where his eyes are really kind of opened.
Yeah. And Fisk was a very, you know, they really planned, and it was three men in the community that served as his advisors, and the one that he writes about most notably is Frank Hosmer, who is his high school principal, someone that he stays in touch with for many, many years and continually. He just, you know, profoundly thanks him whenever he can. But that he needed to go south, that you couldn't start at Harvard in terms mm-hmm. of where he was at, and he needed to get some stuff under him. And so, yeah, he goes to Fisk, and it was an entirely different experience. It wasn't his first experience. He'd gone away for some summers to work waiting tables in Michigan and what have you. So he had certainly encountered, you know, the reality of race in much more striking ways than he had in Great Barrington. But yeah, Fisk was a different place.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I told you in the pre-interview that I had a really good talk with a fellow, Colin Grant, who wrote a book about Marcus Garvey. And Garvey had a kind of parallel experience where he's come from the islands to New York, and New York's kind of booming. And then he decides he needs to see, I guess, real race relations in America, and he goes to the South. for a tour, and he's absolutely shocked by what he sees. He can't believe it. You know, the deference that African Americans show white people in the South. He's just completely shocked by it. And I kind of imagine Du Bois had a similar sort of experience coming from Great Barrington and then going into the South in that way, because it must have been shocking for him. So anyway, to kind of make a very long and interesting story short, he goes to Harvard and then becomes a famous intellectual, starts the NAACP with a bunch of people, and you know, becomes a very significant public intellectual, let's put it that way, probably one of the most significant of the 20th century in the United States. And much of your book is about the attempt of some members of the community in Great Barrington in the 70s. Did it start in the 70s or the 60s? I can't remember.
It starts in the 60s.
Yeah, to commemorate their, I guess, favorite son, their native son, W.E. Du Bois. And maybe you could just pick up the story with the first people who decide that it might be a good idea for Great Barrington to acknowledge that he was, in fact, raised there.
Yeah, I mean, the book really takes a segue, and the first part of the book about, you know, Du Bois' early days in Great Barrington wasn't ever supposed to be what I was doing. But it wasn't until, you know, the 60s part that came in that I realized that it really was important to see how strikingly different the Great Barrington of the 60s was from the Great Barrington within which Du Bois grew up and had all of this support and understanding within. So it's after his death, and the main character is Walter Wilson, and Walter Wilson is the kind of character that a historian would have to invent if he didn't actually exist. He's one of those people that you come across that is that fantastic, and he's at best at worst complicated. He was from the South. He was a member of the Communist Party. He had worked as an ACLU labor organizer in the Deep South in the 1930s, which I think means he was very brave. He was a prolific writer. He was a collector of very expensive Shaker furniture. He was a real estate mogul. He was a humanitarian, and he was an incredibly unethical businessman.
He sounds a lot like an American.
It's interesting because he left nothing behind. I'm sure he burned it all himself. He's someone that when you talk to people about him, which is what I finally had to start doing, you know, I'm not an oral historian, and I didn't want to turn this into a, you know, these are my recollections kind of book. But there was no other way to get at Walter, and he had been, my parents knew him. And one of the first things that anyone ever said about Walter when you asked about him was, oh, his wife was lovely. But, you know, he was the kind of person that was surrounded by a lot of people because he was just that interesting to be around. So my biggest source for him was his lawyer, his personal lawyer, who is, you know, still alive and actually only somewhat semi-retired in Pittsfield, Massachusetts, William Simons. And William Simon spent a lot of time with me just kind of getting into the head of Walter Wilson and why Walter Wilson became the person that kind of said to Great Barrington, we're going to commemorate Du Bois. And it started because of Walter Wilson's real estate acumen. Walter Wilson found the property that was the childhood home of Du Bois. And one of Walter Wilson's real estate clients was Edwin Gordon, who was in New York looking for a second home in the Berkshire area, you know, a very eminent scholar, still has an office at Teachers College at Columbia, and certainly, you know, dead center in the circle of black intellectuals in New York City. And Gordon and Wilson became friends. Because as Gordon told me, when he was looking for a real estate agent, Wilson was the only one that had an equal opportunity symbol in his real estate ads at that time. And so Gordon called him and said, they made this deal, and Gordon got his home, I think, eventually in Steventown, right outside of the Berkshires. So when Walter found the Du Bois, you know, what is now called the boyhood home site, he called Gordon and said, I found it. And Gordon said, let's buy it. So they split it, and it wasn't a terrible amount of money, and they got the deed. And then they started planning. He purchased it. They created a committee. And what their desire was, they wanted to make it a national landmark. Mm-hmm. And I think Walter thought it was a slam dunk. Walter was someone who had, you know, grand plans for lots of things. And like I said, not necessarily the ethical system to completely back it up. William Simons told me, for example, that the reason he severed his relationship with Wilson was the day that Wilson tried to sell a condemned house to a blind man. and there's really not much else you can do.
That sounds like a saying. I could sell a
condemned house
to a blind man. You know, it's,
yeah, and he had lots of he claims he invented the second home industry in the Berkshires in the 1950s and 1960s when, you know, obviously this has been a place of second homes since the mid 19th century.
Let me ask you to pause just for a second and tell us what the property looked like when they found it. And how did they find it?
The property looked awful. The property looked awful until extremely recently. There was a little bit of the cellar left. It was pretty overgrown.
So the place had been abandoned then, or was it how did it fall into disrepair?
It had deteriorated. Well, at one point, it had actually come back into Du Bois' possession. A group of people had purchased it for him for his birthday at the earlier part of the century, but he didn't have enough money to do anything with it, and finally had given up on it. So it kind of fell into disrepair over the course of the 20th century, and then came into Walter's hands. It was pretty much just a field and a cellar hole.
Uh-huh.
And it got worse. It got worse after that.
Right. Yeah.
But he had all kinds of plans for building a museum and the National Landmark campaign. And I think he thought it would be difficult in terms of organization, and I think he thought it would be difficult in terms of fundraising. I didn't think he thought that what happened would happen in terms of the town's reaction to recognizing that, you know, essentially Du Bois once lived here.
Mm-hmm. So explain that engagement, let's say.
Yeah. That engagement I think that what happens to Du Bois and his legacy, if you're going to take kind of what I would say a vulgar historical approach to it, is that he really died at the wrong time. And this was something that he himself recognized. I mean, one of my favorite things that he wrote was to paraphrase him, had he died at 50, you know, he would have been lauded, and by 75, his death was practically requested. he was someone, you know, that when he died in 1963, civil rights was about to have its biggest political spectacle in terms of the March on Washington. But by the time Wilson comes into it, 67, 68, King's assassination, the escalation of the Vietnam War, the dialogue of the Cold War, you know, really simplifying what patriotism meant into very black and white, very Democrat versus communist, totalitarian, you know, versus liberty kinds of ways, Du Bois' legacy didn't stand a chance at that point. You know, dying in Africa, having, you know, the FBI and the State Department pursuing him as his socialist leanings really grew, he became disfavored by colleagues and enemies alike, particularly after the State Department really targeted him. And certainly he was not alone. People like Paul Robeson and what have you were certainly under the same kind of scrutiny. Paul Robeson much more famously, to be sure. And so when Du Bois dies, you know, there's an interesting comparison. He dies in Ghana and a state funeral is held. He dies in Ghana, and yet here in America, very little happens. And so even though the international legacy of Du Bois was terribly secure, he couldn't come home.
Mm-hmm.
Great Barrington, you know, really, really didn't have any kind of mindset, and I don't think probably any small town in America would have, in the midst of the Cold War going full blast in the way that it was, to let somebody, a black communist, who, again, died in Africa, to be considered a neighbor.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And that, I think that was something that Walter Wilson did not expect. But it was something that took fire. And it was something, you know, even I was surprised going into the research for this. I thought it was going to be a really tiny little project. I thought, you know, this will be a great way to go home and do some research and, you know, pound out an article. And then I came across a quote that was from a commander of a VFW in Great Barrington, in which he said that, you know, any kind of commemoration of Du Bois in Great Barrington would be the same thing as building a statue of Adolf Hitler. and that's really what turned the project for me, because I read it and read it and read it and read it and thought, my God, he's comparing W.E.B. Du Bois to Hitler. Which, you know, in our current political climate, people do that all the time now. You know, Hitler's back in vogue in a Tea Party kind of way. But it was really shocking to me that these people weren't just coming forward to say we don't know who he is, or he's not really a native son anymore because he, you know, he went to Ghana. But, you know, this comparison to Hitler really threw me, and that's what turned this what I thought was going to be a very small project about, you know, Walter Wilson's project, into a full-fledged book about the racial politics of the Cold War.
Well, let's set the stage for the debate over memorializing Du Bois by asking or having you tell us how it was that Du Bois became a communist.
Well, and again, I think that most Du Bois scholars would say, you know, it's great that he joined the party and he got a card. He was a socialist, certainly. I mean, Du Bois was a great admirer of the foundational beliefs of the United States. But from his very earliest writings, you can see his emerging recognition of the tension that existed between America's foundational beliefs, you know, ideals of morality and justice and equality. And Du Bois increasingly thought of such things on a global scale, thinking about, you know, human rights rather than just civil rights. But the United States had this insistence on achieving these indisputable objectives via a capitalist system. And that's what I think we see increasingly becoming problematic for Du Bois and increasingly turning Du Bois within these more socialist frameworks, that he was, you know, he was just impatient that American democracy couldn't work, in his view, through a capitalist system, through, you know, that you couldn't have this global idea of social justice, I think is how David Levering Lewis puts it, in this paradox of your economic system.
Yeah, I think it's really important to put this in the right context. We talk about people who became communists in the 30s and 40s and 50s a lot on this show, and one of the things I'm always very quick to mention is that many of the people who we would think of as right-thinking today, who, for example, fought very hard against the Nazis very early, were communists. They were not these kind of parodic Maoist rebels that you see today. They were actually people of some substance who had really thought about these things and had gone over to that side. It was also before we knew or we strongly associated communism with Stalinism. I think there were people that obviously knew in the 30s and 40s that Stalinism had done some very bad things to the communist brand, let's put it that way. But many people who we would today respect and admire had strong communist leanings, and not for no reason. I'm not going to sit here and say that it was a great idea, but they didn't do it foolishly or out of any anti-Americanism or anything like that.
Well, it's a political ideology, and certainly in the earlier parts of the 20th century, it's a political ideology that works quite well with unionism. It works quite well, you know, within ideas of being, you know, workers and workers' rights and industrialization. You need to remember that political ideologies don't start with a stigma, that these stigmas are historically manufactured. Mm-hmm. And Du Bois in a lot of ways is as close to a pure intellectual in some phases of his life as it gets, you know, thinking for thinking's sake.
Yeah, he had one thing that, really was kind of much to his detriment, is he just didn't speak in sound bites. He said some things that if you take them out of context, they sound awful. But if you put them in context, they sound totally reasonable. And I think
he doesn't always sound totally reasonable. Yeah. I mean, you know, he defends Stalin and his defense of totalitarianism, even after things come out about, you know, the Stalinist interpretation of communism.
Yeah.
Du Bois is, but to think about what Du Bois went through and the persecution and his understanding of inequity. One of the ways that I always explain it to students in terms of breaking down, you know, why he joins the Communist Party is it's kind of, you know, why punks in 1970s Great Britain start putting swastikas on themselves.
Yeah.
You know, it's not because they're Nazis. It's because they're trying to inspire hatred and angst and what have you. So it's, you know, it's a very calculated move.
And we should also say that he was hardly alone. You mentioned Robeson, but there were many black intellectuals that that became, I don't know, they became socialists or communists. And this was true all the way through the 60s. I remember when I went to the Soviet Union for the first time in the 80s, and there were posters of Angela Davis all over the place. How do you like that? Angela Davis.
Angela Davis and Henry Ford.
Very popular Angela Davis was. So it was more than a flirtation. It was a conscious decision on their part to kind of join up with these movements. But then, of course, during the Cold War, communism becomes associated with anti-Americanism. And this is really what kind of did Du Bois in Great Barrington. So we can now return to that thread of the conversation and explain to us the debate that went on about how to memorialize Du Bois.
Yeah, and that's what, it's about anti-Americanism. It's about racism, which Wilson is the only one who's willing to really come out and talk about. It's about neighbor. I mean, it's about who belongs in this community and who doesn't. To explore the racial venom of the Cold War. I mean, there are some fantastic books out there that do that. But I think that looking at the Great Barrington situation, you get to see a very small, it's an impossibly local story, and really kind of get into the heads of breaking down this us versus them kind of situation that the Cold War was. You know, who was the us and who was the them? Du Bois, who was so firmly embedded as an us in Great Barrington in his early life, becomes, you know, is transformed into a them during the Cold War. And so it becomes a battle within Great Barrington. It becomes a battle between, you know, those who are considered outsiders, whether it's the summer homers from New York who are working with Wilson. Wilson himself considered to be an outsider. Those who are interested in the NAACP. I mean, essentially, what they're trying to do, what the Du Bois Committee that Wilson forms is trying to do, is they're trying to commemorate civil rights. Well, civil rights is actually still ongoing.
Mm-hmm.
This movement begins before the death of King. So civil rights is certainly an active social movement when Walter Wilson launches the Memorial Committee in Great Barrington. And so this moment of trying to commemorate civil rights by trying to commemorate one of its architects becomes an action of civil rights itself. It becomes a battle. And the book really focuses on the dialogue that takes place at town meetings and the dialogue that takes place in the different local newspapers, you know, the battle that takes place in the letters to the editor and the editorial sections covering this. You really kind of get a very local, you know, inside the homes of Americans view on what the Cold War did to people's mindset.
Mm-hmm. If you could characterize very briefly the arguments on either side, I think that would be useful.
I think that the argument from the Du Bois Memorial Committee was quite simple. He's the greatest thing that Great Barrington ever produced. He is someone that should be recognized. He's a tremendous learning opportunity. He would be a terrific tourist attraction. Walter Wilson always had an economic angle in terms of what he was doing. And it's the right thing to do. I think on the surface, the opposition to that was he was a communist. He wasn't really from here because he left at the age of 18, or he didn't like it here, or he died in Ghana, so he's not even really that American. But then I think that, you know, there's the undercurrent of how can he be one of us? How can we recognize a black intellectual as the most important thing that Great Barrington has ever done?
And I want to talk a little bit about that thesis itself, because, you know, one of the things that I always find is very difficult in my own work, and I think many historians find this, is moving from a thesis like that. Let's put it differently. How do you identify the roots of such a bias? What are the data that are involved? How do you see racism in a context where people are trying to be fearlessly polite? They don't just come out and say the N-word or anything like that. This is actually kind of relevant because I think if you take away the extreme the sort of nutcases in the Tea Party movement. A lot of people say the Tea Party movement is racist. If you take those nutcases away, I always wonder, people say, well, the Tea Party movement is racist. Well, you take away those nutcases, I don't know. How do you tell?
Well, I think that, you know, it's interesting because, and I think that the Tea Party parallels, you know, the Barney Frank showdown over healthcare with the LaRouche youth movement happened about a month before the book came out, and I was talking to my editor and saying, I can't believe the dialogue that's taking place right now. You know, they just called Obama Hitler. All of these posters are coming out with Obama with a little, you know, black mustache, and we're seeing all of these things that are so shockingly similar to the way the dialogue unfolded in the late 60s in Great Barrington.
Exactly.
It was really jaw dropping, you know. But we know that even though the phrase welfare thug doesn't use any word that couldn't be said in polite conversation, that is not an overtly racist thing. That is a racist thing when thrown at Obama. That asking Obama for his birth certificate, you know, some people call it the new racism because it's buried. It's not a Jim Crow kind of approach to race relations. But just because it's, I don't think it's new. I think it's, you know, racism is the same sentiment.
How do we see it though in the Du Bois case?
I think that anytime you hear anti-Americanism and you know, calls of anti-Americanism and chants of patriotism within the Cold War, dealing around ideas of civil rights and what have you, that a red flag goes up, and it is a difficult thing to unpack. It isn't a data kind of research. One of the ways that Walter Wilson talks about it, and Walter Wilson crafts some very interesting theories about history in his overseeing of the Du Bois Memorial Committee, is that Great Barrington, after Du Bois left, never embraced him. That there had never been signs raised, that there had, you know, that the Berkshires, and like I said, the Berkshires is very self-conscious about its place in history and its importance and its cultural value to the United States, and yet he is someone that was completely erased from that, whereas the legacy of just about everybody else has a sign in a museum and a brochure and, you know, fourth grade class field trips. Mm-hmm. And Du Bois was never part of that group, you know, way before he died as a communist in Ghana. Mm-hmm. So there's that. There's kind of this, you know, just nothingness in terms of Du Bois that had always existed in Great Barrington.
Well, let me ask a kind of challenging question about that. How much of that, I remember, I was rather embarrassed when they started to name a lot of things after Ronald Reagan while he was still alive.
Yeah.
I just thought that was just, you know, come on now, hold on here. But maybe, does that have anything to do with it? You know, I don't know if New Englanders are going to raise a monument to anyone who's still, you know,
still
walking around.
Did, you know, Norman Rockwell, actually, in the scheme of things, didn't die all that long ago.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that it was interesting. One local journalist said to me, who had grown up in Adams, which is in North Berkshire and is the homestead of Susan B. Anthony, you know, there's no one there. There's no one on the street that you could stop and say, who's your most important neighbor, and they wouldn't say, you know, everybody would say Susan B. Anthony. You could at any point in, you know, once Norman Rockwell moved from Vermont to Stockbridge, everyone knew he was there.
Yeah.
Everyone talked about him. There was Rockwell stuff everywhere. So I don't know that the death is necessary. It's certainly necessary to be on a postage stamp because it's the law.
Uh-huh.
But in terms of collective memory, I don't think that it's necessarily about whether the person's dead or not.
Uh-huh.
And so I think that, you know, even coverage in the local newspapers when Du Bois was doing incredibly important things in the Soviet Union, in his trips to China, you know, in terms of the Stockholm Peace stuff, all of the, you know, major world events that Du Bois was taking place in, there was never kind of the added paragraph in the local coverage that said, you know, by the by, he's from here.
Mm-hmm.
So I do think that there's, I wouldn't say it's a systematic erasing because I don't know that it was in anyone's game plan, but he's not consciously part of this Berkshire history that, again, is just so important at every level of education and community awareness.
Mm-hmm. It is kind of odd because people in that area of the world, and I've been there quite a bit because my wife is from there, are always very quick to point out that they were abolitionists before abolitionism. You know, they really hated slavery and mm-hmm. Sumner and this and that and the other thing. So it is kind of odd that they wouldn't embrace him during his life. But I guess, was there any particular coded language that they used which you found particularly racist? I know that, you know, as a Russian historian, whenever you see this expression in a Russian newspaper in the 1940s or 50s, rootless cosmopolitan, you know that means Jew. And was there any language that you saw in the newspaper that said, you know, this is a hint to people that he was a black guy?
Did anyone call him articulate?
Yeah, right.
Which is usually your code word. Yeah. I think that again, the categorization, you know, the debate takes place again in 2004, which is one of the reasons that I think, you know, even out of the Cold War, the debate still takes place. And I think that the debate that arises in 2004, which is over the naming of the town's new elementary school, whether or not it should be named for Du Bois or for what have you, it's kind of an open dialogue that the school board starts. I think that the venom with which Du Bois is shot down as a prospective name for that school makes the 60s situation even clearer in terms of the issues of race.
Uh-huh.
Because by 2004, we're not in a Cold War context.
Right.
You would think that we'd kind of gotten over communism. And we know that the vestiges of communism are still there. We see it, you know, in the Olympics. We see it in lots of different places. But the venom with which Du Bois is rejected as the proposed name for the new elementary school, with the same kinds of letters to the editor, you know, being written, I think really kind of brings home that there was something else going on other than the communist membership.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that when you look at that, you know, one letter to the editor, you know, in the 60s they compare him to Hitler. There's an editor, there's a letter to the editor in 2004 over the school issue that compares him to Hussein,
mm-hmm.
Saddam Hussein. I think that these kinds of things are the ways that we kind of get at this more insidious, more codified kind of racism.
Mm-hmm.
I think
I was going to say, let me ask a follow-up to that just to rhetorically. Say, for instance, you were a person that did think that, truly thought in the bottom of your heart that you think that a grade school should not be named after someone who did the things that Du Bois did. How could you express that in a non-racist way?
Well, I think that, you know, I'm hopeful that my mind doesn't look that way. But I think that...
I'm just saying, if you were such a person...
I think that to just explore the reason why. Why, you know, why... That there's lots of ways that racism operates that seem to, on the surface, seem colorblind. And, you know, you were just talking about Tea Party and racist and what have you, and that maybe it wasn't until, you know, the screaming against John Lewis as he, you know, walked to the health care that some people woke up and said that. But, you know, there's ways that policies are written, there's ways that things are done that we know affect particular groups of people and different socioeconomic groups. And so even though something may not look on the surface as racist, the way that it operates and executes. And the communist thing really gives people a way out.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that it continues to do so. So I think that, you know, why would someone be opposed to this person being recognized in their community? That the answer to that question has to be a really difficult one to come up with. I think that, you know, there's a signage debate that takes place in Great Barrington over Du Bois. Again, happened very recently. All the sign was supposed to say was that he was born there. And, you know, one selectman said, well, he was born here. You know, what are we arguing over? And it really should have been that simple. It should have been that simple, and yet it wasn't.
Well, I wanted to say, you know, I mean, I mentioned Angela Davis earlier. I'm a graduate, a proud graduate of Grinnell College here in Grinnell, Iowa. And a few years ago, I guess it was 2 years ago, 3 years ago, my alma mater decided to have Angela Davis come speak at our commencement. And I can tell you, I don't have a racist bone in my body, but I did not like that. I had understood what she had done and what she had said, and I just said, you know, I'm sorry, I cannot get behind that. But I think that by the definition that we've given, that can't be interpreted any other way. That's somehow coded for race. But I guess I don't see that. At least in my own heart, maybe it is. But I
think that there's, and we know this, that there's certain things that are assumed about African Americans or expected of African Americans, particularly successful ones, that aren't really on par with white counterparts. And one of the things that I take a look at in the book is the reaction of Peekskill to a concert that's supposed to happen with Paul Robeson.
And please talk about that.
And the, you know, the Robeson's supposed to give a concert in Peekskill. he is not able to safely do so, it basically turns into a riot. I mean, there's really no other way to explain it. And it's similar to Great Barrington in that a lot of supporters of Robeson and supporters of the concert are Jewish intellectuals from New York City who have houses in Peekskill. But, you know, we're talking about stones being thrown at the car containing Paul Robeson.
Sure.
And that's not rational behavior.
No, that one, no problem with that one at all.
And so I think that, you know, there's a sense in terms of the expectations of Du Bois by Great Barrington that he's an ingrate.
Yeah.
You know, there's almost this assumption in terms of this dialogue that, you know, we did this for him despite the fact that he's black.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we supported him and we recognized his intellectual worth in high school and we helped send him to college and we supported him, or at least our ancestors did. And then he goes and joins the ultimate enemy and goes to Africa and leaves us. And I think that we see this over and over and over again,
mm-hmm.
In terms of what happens when someone, you know, loses favor, when an African American loses favor in the public eye, that there really is this kind of sense that this person, that these actions indicate that they're ungrateful, and that's mm-hmm. where the anti-Americanism comes from, and that's where the racist supposition comes from, that it's a real slap in the face to the good guys.
Right.
And I think, you know, what you said about abolitionism before, you know, Great Barrington is in the heart of the good
yeah.
guys.
Yeah.
You know, they're the captains of the good guys. They're from Massachusetts,
yeah.
54th Regiment
yeah.
to gay marriage. I mean, across the board,
yeah.
being from Massachusetts is something I'm incredibly proud of.
Yeah.
But it doesn't mean that it's easier to make these kinds of decisions around complicated, you know, situations.
Yeah.
And it doesn't mean, you know, that Scott Brown doesn't get elected
right.
in the state of Massachusetts.
Sure.
Yeah. So how is... for those of our listeners who haven't been to Great Barrington, and I strongly suggest that you go there, and I'm not working for the Great Barrington Chamber of Commerce.
No, but it's beautiful.
It's beautiful. It's beautiful out there. How is Du Bois remembered today? If you walked around Great Barrington, what would you see? And if you started to talk to people about Du Bois, would they know about him? Is it taught in the grade school? That kind of thing.
Yeah. I don't know how much it's taught. The private school's been doing a lot, and they actually sent a group of students to Ghana recently.
Really?
To visit the homestead there. He, you can find him if you look for him, but not without trying. The University of Massachusetts now owns the property, and from the moment that the first draft of this book was done, they've done a remarkable job. There's a small parking lot at the Boyhood site. You know, it is a national landmark. Wilson's campaign was eventually successful. In the early 70s, but then it becomes overgrown and kind of ignored again. UMass takes the deed, and they've created a parking lot and some signage and an actual trail. The first time that I went to the Boyhood home, you needed a machete to get anywhere near it. And you can now walk. That said, you could drive by it pretty easily. There's
uh-huh.
not a huge sign, and there's plenty of people who call me and say, you know, I looked for it. I was there for the weekend and still can't find it.
Uh-huh.
There are some really interesting local historians doing some great work about African-American heritage in Western Massachusetts in general. There's some cool anthropological projects going on around the Du Bois site in terms of early African-American New England life, again, coming out of the University of Massachusetts. That said, I think that the school debate that took place, you know, not very many years ago, indicates that there's still a lot of anger, and you know, I find that when I've done several events up there at this point around the book, and there's a lot of really supportive people because those are the kinds of people that are going to come to a book event
right.
about this. But there's also some, you know, I don't want to call them holdouts because I don't think they're holdouts.
Mm-hmm.
I think that they are part of a very viable group of people and what they're thinking. And I, you know, it's tough.
Yeah.
Du Bois is someone that this group of people tried to memorialize, but Du Bois is also someone that if you look at him politically and ideologically, he can't die.
Mm-hmm.
So it's tough to memorialize someone that continues to sort of haunt
mm-hmm.
America.
Mm-hmm. In a way, I kind of think that, you know,
Du Bois, as he exists in not just American consciousness, but I suppose in the consciousness of people of Western Massachusetts, as a kind of complicated figure, is a positive sign, because we have a tendency... I think everyone has a tendency to turn, live people into marble statues. And, you know, Lincoln is the great example that I always give on this show. You know, Lincoln held some views which I think we would not probably agree with today. And people tend to forget that because he's been made into marble. And so, you know, someone like Du Bois was incredibly complex. He lived a very long time in a very complicated time. And, you know, I'm sort of happy that his complexity has been preserved, that we understand him to be a full-blooded human being and not a marble statue. I mean, I don't particularly like the rancor on either side, but, you know, he was a person all in all. And he wasn't quite clear many times about what he thought and was looking to do good and did the best he could. And, you know, that's, I think, most of us, to be honest with you. I came away from the book reading, you know, thinking, well, it's terrific that something that happened that long ago is being discussed at all, because most things are just forgotten. So,
well, and it's, you know, the person that, it's interesting you bring up Lincoln, because the person that I often use as a comparative is Jefferson. And, you know, Jefferson is like Teflon Man in American history.
Yeah.
But the reason that, you know, aside from the, you know, the interracial relationships and what have you that we, you know, about Jefferson, like Du Bois, wrote everything down.
Yeah.
I mean, probably next to Du Bois, you know, the most prolific thinker-writer that the United States has ever seen. And one of the things that happens when people live a long time and write everything down and are brilliant is they change their minds about stuff.
Yeah, that's right.
And Americans in general have a real problem with people who change their minds.
No, they don't. I mean, we don't like that at all. No,
John Kerry learned that the hard way.
Yeah, we don't like that. No. Mm-mm.
You're not supposed to become more informed about things.
Uh-uh.
You're not supposed to change your mind. You're supposed to stick to your guns.
Yeah, you lack integrity.
Kind of thing.
Whatever integrity is, yeah. No, that's right.
So,
I think you're exactly right.
Yeah. It's that said, it's a little worrisome about why Du Bois gets to be complicated and Jefferson just gets to be a founding father.
Well, I think there's also a lot of discussion about Jefferson as well. Jefferson, I think most people that listen to this show will know that Jefferson was a, to put him in the worst light, he was a, you know, atheist, slaveholding, quasi-rapist. He did a lot of other great things.
Yeah,
but you know,
he's still on the nickel. I mean, when you're asking about, you know, how do you know this is something to explore from a perspective of the history of racism?
Yeah.
I think what we let some historical figures get away with, and what we don't let some historical figures, you know, get away with anything.
Yeah.
And Du Bois is someone that hasn't been allowed to get away with anything,
right.
despite something like co-finding the NAACP.
Yeah, I think you're right. But you know, again, it's one of these cases where. Actually, that's what kind of a huge revelation for me was this, and the reason we're talking is Colin Grant's biography of Marcus Garvey. And I kind of always thought of Marcus Garvey as kind of a buffoon. I think that's what he has been depicted in that way. But he's an incredibly important and interesting guy, really amazing, and it opened my eyes. Amazing guy. And we've just kind of forgotten that because we've stereotyped it. So, I think it's kind of a hopeful sign that we're even talking about Du Bois now and that people debate his legacy. Because I think the overall lesson is just don't, you know, it's right out of Francis Bacon, not the painter, but the philosopher, don't make idols. You know,
right.
Just don't make idols. That everybody is going to have their foibles and, you know, don't throw any stones in glass houses and all that stuff. So, yeah, I thought it was a... I admired the people of Great Barrington for even talking about it.
Yeah, there you go.
You know, but I mean, think of things like the removal of the American Indians. I mean, this is something that's just never discussed. It happened all over the United States, and we never mention it. You know, removal. Out of removal, that's even sanitized. But, you know, we live in that legacy, and we just don't talk about it or acknowledge it at all. So good on the people of Great Barrington in my mind. So we've taken up a lot of your time, and I really want to thank you. It's been a fascinating conversation. Tell us what your... next project is?
My next project. I'm continuing. I have my own series at Temple University Press, boarding. So I'm continuing my work there, you know, acquiring and editing and and doing cool things with them. I'm actually currently writing a piece about the Red Sox.
What is that exactly? I don't know what that is.
Who are they?
That? Yeah.
That fantastic baseball team in Boston. And ideas of community and sports. I'm actually writing using the theories of diaspora, ideas of diaspora to talk about Red Sox Nation. So that's a project that's kind of fledgling right now, and that's pretty much what's taking up most of my mind. There's a lot of stuff that I've been working on, again, in terms of kind of current political dialogues. regarding socialism and healthcare and what have you, mm-hmm. Kind of coming off of this Du Bois book.
Mm-hmm.
So I've been doing a lot of writing in that direction, a lot of looking at the Tea Party, which is, you know, mm-hmm. words that, as a girl from Massachusetts, strike me in a very particular way.
Well, sure. No,
being used in a very different way right now.
So
kind of unpacking the spectacle of all that.
I think that's historically very rich territory because... It's just very rich territory. There's a lot to be said about the revival and use of a sign like that. And I mean, sign sort of in the semiotic sense, you know, like.
Yeah, absolutely.
So there's a lot to be said. So it's good. It sound great to me. So you finish any of them and you call me and I will have you back on the show.
Very cool. Thanks so much,
Marshall. Get back to the word processor, though.
So
So anyway, I should tell our listeners that we have been talking to Amy Bass today about her book, Those About Him Remain Silent, The Battle Over W.E.B. Du Bois. I highly recommend it for those of you who will be vacationing in the Berkshires this summer, and there are thousands of you. You want to pick a copy of it up and take it to the place itself and read the book and think about Amy and listen to this interview, okay? So, Amy, thank you very much for being on the show. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Marshall.
All right, bye-bye. You've been listening to an interview with Amy Bass about her new book, Those About Him Remain Silent, The Battle Over W.E.B. Du Bois. I'm Marshall Poe, the host of New Books in History. I hope you have a great week.